Good afternoon. It's interesting, the government shutdown aversion. I don't think they have an aversion to it, but they did avert a shutdown of the government last night, truly again at the 11th hour, I think an hour and, 15 minutes or something like that. They'd struck a deal. It was being reported before it actually became known as a fact. But I've been watching the scope of the so-called cuts. And there will be a much bigger fight coming in about 2 or 3 months and thereafter over the 2012 budget. The 2012 projected deficit is $1.65 trillion. That's unsustainable. The very deficit of just this 1 year is bigger than most of the economies of the nations of the world. Only a few nations have a bigger economy than the scope of our deficit, which is an astonishing thing, and that's just 1 year of deficit. But if you want to appreciate the $38.5 billion cuts where both sides practically fought to the death, think of it this way. If the debt for 2012 at $1 2/3 trillion were a $10 bill, the government almost shut down, came within about 75 minutes of shutting down over a fight between the Democrats recommending a cut of 2.4 cents and the Republicans recommending a cut of 36.3 cents. You think they're going to go into a fight the next time and figure out how to cut $10? No. No, but you have to put it in proportion. It's about who can gain the upper hand. As one man said this morning on the news, the whole thing has become a contest over the 2012 election. The greatest nation in the history of the world is being destroyed because 535 people want to hold the upper hand to power in 2012. That's really what it's about. If you look at the left, they love to call the right as guilty of holding on to ideological cuts. An example would be when they talk about preserving women's health, what they mean is the right to butcher babies. We're talking about abortion under the guise of women's health. And if the Republicans want to cut abortion funding, just a few billion dollars, that's an ideological position to want to save lives. To want to butcher them, now that's not an ideological position, but that's the way they spin it. Think about the whole concept of balancing the budget, which the Republicans want to do just as a whole, not the items within it, but just the concept of doing what all the rest of us always do. You and I and companies and most other countries know you cannot live this way. The only people who can live this way have printing presses in their basement. The government has the biggest printing press in a basement in the world, the federal government of the United States, but the whole idea of just cutting spending down to approximately the $2 trillion that's going to come in 2012 instead of the $3.65 trillion that's going to be spent, the very concept of balancing a budget is now considered an ideological position. Even though all other entities on planet Earth, all organizations, all companies, all families, all individuals, and most other governments understand you can't spend more than you take in, the left has managed to paint the right as ideological for wanting to follow the pattern of the rest of the world. It's astonishing. So I can't help but comment on that. The troops are going to get paid for a few more days, I guess was the big one. Watch out when they go into the entitlement programs. That's where the big money is to be had. I might quickly comment on this fellow who has his 2,000 billboards in the United States and a radio program and others, Harold Camping. Some of you are maybe familiar with him, most are not. In all honesty, I wasn't, but I'm familiar with that kind of thinking. He obviously has a lot of support because he has a pretty big reach. But I find it surprising, almost to the point of shocking, that a television crew wants to come here from Holland and film me. Trust me, I'll have plenty to say about it, but they control the power of the editorial cuts that they'll make to the video, but it's not a hostile interview. They're coming here. We're the host. They're traveling a long way, and I want to talk about more than the rapture, which is supposedly what this guy thinks is happening, and then it's kind of the end of all things. I want to show how his timing is wrong, in addition to the fact that the rapture is an unbiblical fiction. But I'll get a chance to talk about the kingdom of God on what amounts to national television because of the structure of Dutch television. And of course, Holland is one of the 12 tribes of Israel. Zebulun essentially resides there, so it's a wonderful opportunity for free. And perhaps the bigger thing to me might be, and this will turn on a lot of the prayers of God's people, who might see it and want to go further. All right, fine, you had a certain crowd on the History Channel, I was there, and Nightline, they filmed me but didn't air it, and other radio interviews I've done and here and in other parts of the world, but it's what it can lead to. As the world gets darker and darker, more and more people are looking for voices of clarity. They may be looking for political clarity, maybe looking for economic clarity or moral clarity. Schools and education is breaking down. They may be looking for educational clarity, but ultimately the one that some are looking for, religious clarity, transcends as a kind of an umbrella over all of those kinds of things. And we speak to all the elements of what's going wrong in the world, but they all come back to whether or not individuals and nations will obey God. If they did, everything's fine. If they don't, everything goes wrong. Now, I wanted to introduce the sermon in the typical way that I have been doing and most of the time will continue to do, by discussing certain news. It actually sets up what I'm going to cover. I'm not going to talk about prophecy, but in a way, I guess I am, when you understand the subject that we will come to, but it's not really prophecy per se. There are so many things I could cover every single week now that I find myself the next week saying there's even more. With the passing of 7 days, there are so many events and trends that Christ talked about that keep coming up. I fight the same fight that the budget cutters do. What in the world do I cut and not mention when I only have about 15 minutes to set up the sermon? Of course, for 40 years of my ministry, I never opened sermons, at least not routinely, with a discussion of things that are happening prophetically. Now I do. I feel I need to. I feel it's incumbent on me to keep God's people reminded of the fact that they're supposed to keep themselves aware of watching all of the horrific things that are going on and getting worse and greater in number. I hate to say it, but I like to put it this way. The problems on planet Earth are growing worse. The existing problems are growing worse, and new ones are appearing. Here's one. A deadly drug-resistant superbug is spreading in California. This one is really stunning, and it's only one of two articles on this subject. It's called CRKP. It stands for the long name of a particular bacterium. But it's resistant to almost all antibiotics. Now, it's not really new, but it's exploding in California, and it's never been seen outside the East Coast, or it's never been seen to be as intransigent as it is, if I can put it that way, to antibiotics. It adds weight to the general concerns regarding overuse of antibiotics. And people now going into hospitals in California, I think 350 people caught it in just one county in a short period of time in just one state, California, big state. I'm going to move quickly because I have a lot to tell you. But here's a bigger one. Scientists find superbugs in New Delhi drinking water. Now consider this, understanding Christ said there would be pestilences. A gene that makes bugs highly resistant to almost all known antibiotics has been found in bacteria in water supplies in New Delhi used by local people for drinking, washing, and cooking. If you get this bug in you, now it's a gene that will mutate a variety of superbugs into what are called superbugs. Listen, the NDM1 gene, which creates what some experts describe as a superbug or bugs, has spread to germs that cause cholera and dysentery and is circulating freely in various kinds of bacteria in the Indian capital of New Delhi, 14 million people. The inhabitants of New Delhi are continually being exposed to multi-drug-resistant and NDM1-positive bacteria. It's estimated that perhaps as many as 500,000 are carrying it right now in just that one city. It first emerged in India 3 years ago and is now spread across the world and been found in a wide variety of bugs. It's a gene, that gets into these bugs and then wraps them in kind of a Kevlar, which is bulletproofing. And it's found here, including familiar pathogens like E. coli. No new drugs are on the horizon for at least 5 to 6 years to tackle it. And experts are concerned that only a few major drug companies, such as, and they name a few, still have strong antibiotic development programs. The economy and revenue has cut back research and development a lot of these drug companies. Now, God is our healer, but the world doesn't know that, so they believe that drugs will heal you, and doctors are healers, or that God heals, but he now heals through medical science, which I'm covering in a new series of broadcasts on healing. And so they have cut back on research and development, content to make the profits that they'll make on existing drugs. So here come these super bugs with the ability to proliferate because of this gene that gets in them. And new antibiotics are not on the horizon for 5 to 6 years. And that's just a few companies that are pursuing them. Well, we know we don't even have 5 to 6 years. So that's another fascinating subject. Here's another article. 4 more confirmed of dengue fever, 12 more suspected in different parts of Hawaii, an outbreak. Here's another article. Speaking of famine and disease and war, here's another article. Corn demand outrunning supplies. From Chicago, U.S. corn planting will expand this year to cover the second largest area since World War II and still fail to meet demand for feed and ethanol, driving prices to their highest in at least 34 years. Remember, in just the last 1 year, 44 million people on Earth have been driven right to the edge of absolute starvation. And the worst is about to come, according to those who forecast such things. Corn will rise 5.7% to an average of $7.15 a bushel in the third quarter, the most since at least 1977. My father-in-law is an expert on corn. I mean, really an expert on corn, and of course gardening in some ways. And he lives in corn country, but more and more farmers in the Midwest, he lives in northern Illinois, more and more farmers are just switching over to soybeans because it's too expensive. And it is somewhat dangerous to plant corn, not soybeans, because soybeans mature earlier, and if you get an early fall, bye-bye corn, and then bye-bye farmer. But corn goes into 4,000 food products. Go check your shelves, 4,000. That is a serious problem, and we've been talking about it. Here's another article. These are all just this week. That comes out of Wichita, Kansas. This is MSNBC.com. Rats. Another reason to watch your step in New York. Vast millions of rats, who on average carry between 35 and 40 diseases, are exploding in New York. And it's unbelievable to just read the particulars. I don't have time to go into all of them. But there are twice as many rats in Paris. Some say maybe 3 times as many rats in Paris as the number of people, which is 8 million. What happens when God unleashes those, which he says in several places he's going to do? Drought hits southern U.S. pretty hard. Here's another subject. While California is basking in record snowpack that's pretty much eliminated the drought there, it is still a serious problem in the southern United States. Drought conditions are expected to persist and worsen for the next 3 months across the USA's southern tier and across the mid-Atlantic seaboard. Large portions of the Southwest and southern plains and Florida and southeast are all still enduring severe to extreme drought conditions. Most people think of, okay, wait till summer and see if there's drought. Drought can strike in the winter. I've learned that and seen it. I've tried to drill into the ground in spring, and it's like drilling into concrete. This has been one of the driest winters. People don't think they're cold and they're not worried about whether the sun is hot and there's been rain. And particularly, there's a little snow cover on a frozen ground. Everything's fine, thank you. No, not necessarily, and in this case, not at all. Now, Texas is the hardest hit. Extreme drought. Half the state. Watch these things as they continue to create what some are calling the perfect storm. Forecasters now expect 5 big or major hurricanes. Those are Category 3 or above. A 50% chance, roughly, that one will hit the Gulf Coast and a 50% chance that it'll hit the East Coast. And that's important because It's a threat to oil and natural gas interests. When Katrina and Rita hit, was it 05? I forget, were 4, 6? I forget what year it was now. Maybe it was 6. Of course, apart from the over 1,800 people that were killed, $91 billion in damage. Now remember, all of this is compounding. Occurred. 115 energy platforms were shut down. 95% of all the drilling in the Gulf ended. 30% of all of the refinement capability ended just because of two storms. But that's been a while, so people aren't thinking about it these days. Most people are not aware that a couple hundred thousand people never returned to New Orleans. New Orleans, that's right. Didn't something happen back there? Didn't they get some hard rain one night? What happened there? That's kind of the way it is with people, almost. All right, now I want to switch subjects to religion. I already talked about it a little bit with this fellow. But we know, and you heard a reference to somebody, and we get a lot of comments on people who have appreciated the abomination of desolation having been made clear to them in literature and in the recent broadcast. But brethren, one of the things that has to happen prophetically that Daniel makes clear is there have to be sacrifices reinstituted in Jerusalem. That is bedrock to prophecy because the Bible foretells them being cut off. Well, you can't cut off what hasn't started yet. So one of the things you watch for is a movement to start them again. Well, the annual attempts to resume the Passover sacrifice received a first significant rabbinical backing recently. And then this chief rabbi, a prominent religious Zionism leader, has called on the public to perform the sacrifice mitzvah on the eve of the Jewish holiday in about 2 weeks. Now, probably not going to happen. But the rabbi warned, and this is what's important, this is a motivation. The rabbi warned that Jews evading the mitzvah were risking kareth, which is a supernatural punishment, obviously from God, for transgressing Jewish law. That's going to be the same thing you hear out of Europe in defense of traditional Christianity. This Rabbi Zvi Hirsch Kalischer, I hope I pronounced that correctly, one of the founders of modern and religious Zionism, had asked the Turkish Sultan to allot an area on the Temple Mount for the erection of an altar for a Passover service. You don't have to see a temple built, but you do have to see an altar built. Prophecy says that. It's just fascinating to see now that more are pushing for it. The Passover sacrifice could be slaughtered in front of the Dome of the Rock Plaza. Yeah, tell that to the Arabs. I mean, there's no chance that's going to happen. In order to overcome the greatest obstacle, beyond the political problem, an altar must be erected, the rabbi said. And he also called for the preparation of sacred priesthood clothing. Leviticus describes what the priests have to wear. Addressing the international diplomatic ramifications, he said, we are being threatened that any movement on our part on the Temple Mount will launch the Third World War. But we can free our souls of the horror of the Gentiles just like we freed ourselves before the Exodus. God will intervene and protect us, and there won't be a Third World War. We have to obey him. And then, they want to start what Exodus and Numbers call the morning and evening sacrifices. There's another one. A surge in Satanism sparks rise in demand for exorcists, say Catholic Church. There are more and more people who are turning up demon-possessed. One of our ministers cast a demon out just this week. I had to teach him how to do it, and he did it. And it was quite a dramatic affair. If you've never done it before, if you've never seen the power of demons, and don't realize that there's going to be a surge, no question about that. There are a variety of verses that could be used to show that. And they might be surprised that the Catholic Church is reporting large numbers of people who are demon-possessed. Of course, they think they have the ability to cast them out. They don't. They don't have Christ's authority. But it's a very, very interesting article. And they call it a rise in Satanism. But Satanism is a little bit different than demon possession. I don't even understand the difference. And then another article, Catholics quit church in droves last year. We hear from huge numbers of Catholics who just understand their churches just teaches blithering nonsense that's utterly unbiblical in every regard. So the Pope has to take action. Catholics quit church in droves last year. You have to understand the forces at work in decision makers' thinking. There are forces that are pushing the Catholic Church. There are forces that push economists, forces that push politicians. There are forces that push churches, and you have to understand them. There is a force pushing the far-right movement in Europe. Here's an article about social ills driven largely by Islamics who have flooded into France. 20% of France now are Islamic, and that doesn't sit well with French Catholics or the fellow in the Vatican who leads them. And when they shut down work and streets all through Paris several times a day so that tens of thousands of people can kneel down against French law while the police actually protect them, it's offensive. And the far right is reacting to it. And here's an incredible article. The far right National Front, under the new leadership of this woman, are reacting to what they see. And of course, conditions in the Middle East are emboldening Islamics the world over. That's its own separate discussion. Now to another subject. The United States has dumped another ally. First, it basically dumped Israel as an ally, but won't say it. The president has pushed away from America Britain, who is an ally. We dumped Mubarak, who was an ally. And Mubarak was an ally of Israel, so when we dumped one of our allies and pushed him out of office, we also made a decision for Israel. Oh, we're sorry, nation of 7 million, we're dumping an ally of 8.5 million Egyptians under, okay, he's a strong man, he's a dictator. And I'm just trying to explain from the human position that ally you had. We've offended the Saudis so greatly that they're basically turning to the Chinese and the Japanese to sell their gas. One in every 9 barrels of oil that comes out of the sand anywhere in the world does so in Saudi Arabia. When you offend the Saudis, that's serious. Never mind what's going on in Libya. So try to understand what's happening in the United States. Try to understand. Now, a Gentile leads the United States government. A Gentile now leads the French government, an Eastern European. Look through history for centuries and see if the Japanese ever put a non-Japanese in charge of their country. See if the Chinese ever did it. Anybody think the Germans would put a non-German in charge of Germany? Would vote him in? Not a chance. They might vote a woman in like they did, but nowhere else. We pushed the Yemeni president out. He was another ally. Very strong ally in fighting Al-Qaeda. One after another after another. Would the Russians ever put a non-Russian in charge? Check all the last prime ministers of Italy and see if even one of them was even partly non-Italian. Check all the Arab nations. They always put their own in. Not silly, foolish Manasseh. And not Reuben, France, another tribe of Israel. So, trying to push the Yemeni president out. He's besieged. We'll see what happens. And finally, two articles that really set up the sermon. The fourth category of things we can look at here is the continued breakdown of character. The very biggest problem on planet Earth, which is driving all the other problems, is the breakdown of basic character. It says in the last days, Paul wrote to Timothy, perilous times shall come, and then he didn't list economic problems, he didn't list educational problems, he didn't list political problems. He listed the breakdown of character in people. Men shall be lovers of their own selves, proud, boasters, heady, unthankful, without natural affection, fierce, despisers of those that are good, and yet at the end, strangely enough, they find a way to have a form of godliness. That's what Paul warned about would be one way that the end of the age is defined. Nobody is building character anymore. Nobody's even teaching it. And that's leading to a giant problem, which is going to be the centerpiece of the sermon. Here's an article. We've become a nation of takers, not makers. Abraham Lincoln once said, America must always remember we are to govern the people, not employ the people. Now, keep in mind, today in America, there are nearly twice as many people working for the government, 22.5 million, than in all of manufacturing, 11.5 million. That's why the shutdown was such a big problem. 800,000 people just in the general environs of Washington, D.C., we're not going to get a paycheck. But 22.5 million people work for city, state, or federal governments. They're not all working for the federal government. This is an almost exact reversal of the situation in 1960. I remember 1960 like it was yesterday, when there were 15 million workers in manufacturing and 8.7 million collecting a paycheck from the government. So you went from 2 to 1 to 1 to 2. That's why this is called the Rust Belt. Akron, Canton, Cleveland, Pittsburgh, Buffalo, Rochester, Detroit. I remember when Cleveland was 950,000 people. In the last census, they were 396,000. Detroit, worse. And virtually all the big cities of America, worse. Because our jobs are all going overseas. That's why you have problems with airplanes. We find out that people this week who are fixing our airplanes and the skin's ripping off of them, they're cracking and there's engine problems, they're being fixed in, was it Costa Rica or Nicaragua? And all the instruction manuals, this is a fascinating smaller point, but all the instruction manuals are written in English, and a lot of the people who work on those planes can't speak or read English. No wonder the planes are having trouble. They're grounding them. There's just a compounding of problems. We're becoming a nation of service industry. People work for spas, and they work for retailers. They build golf courses so people can go enjoy pleasure. We don't actually make hard goods anymore. And finally, the biggest global killer, it came out April 1st, a week ago yesterday, is patient negligence. The greatest single reason people die is they no longer have the character to take care of themselves. One of the most stunning articles I have ever read. The alarming increase in chronic conditions has the world's healthcare authorities worried, the article begins. Diabetes, cancer, chronic respiratory disease, hyperlipidemia, which is high cholesterol, hypertension, strokes, and heart disease are all on the rise. In fact, they are together collectively the leading cause of mortality in the world, representing 60% of all deaths. Sadly, the increase is driven largely by poor lifestyle choices. Little exercise, people can't motivate themselves, too much processed foods, smoking, they can't stop, they're addicted. Smoking is rising again. In the United States, about half the adult population, about 130 million people, are suffering from a chronic condition, in effect, by choice. Essentially, weakness of character. And then it cites other parts of the world. We're well placed to overtake the U.S., now this person writing is a South African, as the world's most obese nation. 50% of our population is overweight or obese, citing South Africa. And then they say one of the solutions would be if everybody who takes drugs just would continue to remember to take those drugs to fix their problem. In other words, doc, here I am. My body's almost shot by choice. Give me something. Shoot me with something. Give me something I can pop or I can rub on. It'll make my problems go away. Just don't tell me I have to show character. Don't tell me I have to develop willpower. Don't tell me to curb myself where I don't want to, or to exercise myself where I don't want to. I want a magic bullet. Now, both the announcements and the sermonette talked about a recent broadcast. I think I filmed it 17 days ago, and it was posted last night on overcoming. And it's been on my mind ever since beginning to prepare that broadcast. We now have a two-week lead time. I actually gave it a little before, more than 2 weeks before that, because I went out to visit the brethren in California. So overcoming has been on my mind. It's also important because by the time everybody else hears this sermon, 5 of the 7 days of unleavened bread will be over. There'll be only 2 to go. And it will be crucial, with 2 days left, to ask, am I removing spiritual leaven from my life? Every sermon you would ever hear on overcoming, on defeating character problems, is in effect a sermon on leaven. And we needed to take an interlude, I think I explained this, from the series on the days of the Son of Man. I'll be back doing that in 2 weeks. Now, it's a little different kind of sermon for the rest of the time that I deliver it. It's a little different. First, over 40 years ago, when I was a student in college, I was about 20, so I guess it's 42 years ago, I made a decision, partly because of my genetics and who I was born to. My mother was a speech champion and a debate champion in the state of Indiana, both as a woman in the 30s. That's unusual. My father was a salesman, and I came to love words. My father's very persuasive. My mother was a good speaker, and you're a little kid growing up in that environment, and you're forced to read. I had to read a book a week, even in the summer, my entire childhood. Whose mother makes them do that? But mine did, and what I hated then, I am thankful for eternally now. My mother was not an educator, but she was an educator. And I made a decision, based coupling that with certain things I heard at Ambassador College, that I wanted to develop a style of speaking. I've never talked about this since my first sermonette almost 41 years ago, but I'll say it now because it won't apply today. I wanted, of course, to be interesting. I wanted to spend a lot of time bringing facts and information rather than saying the same old, which may have been spiritually true. But if it wasn't interesting, who was going to be motivated to change their life? If I didn't appear to be interested in what I was saying, it's a travesty of justice to expect the people listening to me to be interested in doing anything about it. So that was the first thing I determined, that I had a burden on me to make the doctrines of God interesting, and I would answer to God if I couldn't take the truths of the Bible, the most fascinating information in the history of the world and the universe, and make it interesting. I would answer to God, never mind, I wouldn't help his people. So it was one decision I made. And I guess those who've heard me through the years will have to decide whether I achieved that or not. But secondarily, there was a style that I wanted to bring. I felt that there is a way to bring a message with a certain drama and mystery. It might seem strange to you. I'm taking you inside a kind of a strategy, all for the purpose of telling you I'm not going to do it this time. But a certain mystery. I felt if I could be interesting and not tell people in the first three sentences of my sermon what I was going to cover, it would be harder for them to tune out. It would be harder to prepare the message to keep them learning and understanding and growing as the message developed, but not know exactly where it's going to go until you get there. Sort of like heading out to Los Angeles, and the closer you get to Los Angeles, the more you think it might be the destination. But if you take off going west, I wonder if we're going to Indianapolis. Well, there went Indianapolis, maybe St. Louis. Oh, well, bye-bye St. Louis. How about Kansas City? Maybe it's Denver. And eventually you see the destination, but you appreciate the trip on the way. So I would try to add a certain mystery, which allowed then the key points at the end of the sermon or nearing the end of the sermon to hit with a much greater force because the listeners had been set up to understand what would at that point be delivered. Now, with the apostasy and the advancement of prophecy in the age where, in effect, of the 6,000 years allotted to man, most of the sand has fallen through the hourglass and there isn't much time left. And because God's people are generally, not all of them, but generally much more focused, much more interested, a message's power and clarity sometimes needs to hit from the beginning. And sometimes, rather than taking people on a journey, the force and effect of that sermon ought to hit, if I may use these words, almost just punch people in the chest and take their breath away. Now look, brethren, I'm going to cover something today for the balance of the second half of the sermon. I'm going to have to move to do it. There are not going to be a lot of verses, but there are going to be some. And they have to do with the subject of overcoming, but in a little different way than you thought of. First of all, turn over to John chapter 16. John 16. And remember again that everybody but those of us here are going to hear this sermon during the days of unleavened bread because of the delay that we use. Now we'll be reading these verses on the night of the Passover in just a few days, a week from tomorrow night. Christ said in John 16 and verse 28, I came forth from the Father and have come into the world. Again, I leave the world and go to the Father. It'll be difficult for people who had been around him in a very intimate setting for 3.5 years, and maybe some of them grew up with him. and all of a sudden he's going to be gone. His disciples said to him, "Lo, now speak you plainly and speak no proverb." Now, interesting how human beings will talk to God. "Now, God, just be a little more plain, no proverbs, just speak plainly." Would you do that? Well, they did. "Now are we assured that you know all things." I guess familiarity can breed its own certain kind of contempt, but Christ didn't rebuke them. I think it probably was said a little differently. It's recorded here that way. "Now are we sure that you know all things? Indeed, not that any man should ask you." Now, that's very respectful. Okay. "By this we believe that you came forth from God." And Jesus answered them and said, "Do you now believe?" Now, what's the subject here? "Behold, the hour comes." Yes, is now come. We're near the very end. This is the last Passover he would keep with them. He would be crucified in less than 24 hours. "That you shall be scattered, every man to his own, and shall leave me alone. And yet I'm not alone, because the Father's with me. Now these things I have spoken to you, that in me you might have peace." It'd be devastating to witness what happens to Christ, and then he's gone. He's just gone. He's resurrected, and you would see him for another 40 days. We all understand that, before Pentecost and the birth of the New Testament church in AD 31. But in the world, you shall have tribulation. It's going to be important to understand that we can have peace in a world filled with trials. Tribulation is difficult. It's extreme trials, tests, tribulation. "But be of good cheer. I have overcome the world." Now, that said, turn to Revelation 3. We're going to look at several verses back to back, pretty basic. And I hope, in a way, what I'm going to say to you in a few moments punches you in the chest. I say that in love. The Bible says it's written for doctrine and inspiration and, of course, instruction in righteousness, of course, correction and so forth. In Revelation 3 and verse 21, "To him that overcomes will I grant to sit with me in my throne, even as I also overcame and am set down with my Father in his throne." Now, all of the different eras of God's church were told to overcome. Look at chapter 2, verse 26, but a special difficulty at the end. "And he that overcomes and keeps my works unto the end, to him will I give power over the nations." Well, power and sitting on a throne are tied directly to overcoming. What kind of overcoming? "Even as I overcame." How hundreds of millions of people who profess to be Christians can think they do not have to copy Jesus Christ is the single greatest mystery about false Christianity. If you just read two verses and never read anything else in the Bible, you would understand that a true Christian is one who lives a life like Christ. It isn't Christ did it all for you, and then you go live the same life you did before because you somehow found a way to give your heart to him. 1 Peter 2 and verse 21. 1 Peter 2 and verse 21. "For even hereunto were you called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that you should follow his steps." Now, part of the example is he suffered, and we have tribulation in the world. But he left us an example in everything that he did. And a Christian follows his steps. Well, how do you know it doesn't just mean we suffer like him? Well, who did no sin? Neither was guile found in his mouth. Christians battle sin. It's just that plain. Who, when he was reviled, reviled not again. When somebody curses you out in traffic, you are one who doesn't curse them back. When he suffered, he threatened not. There's no vengeance in his heart, but committed himself to him that judges righteously. And that's just very basic verses, no mystery here. Matthew 5, I'm a third of the way through the Sermon on the Mount, Christ's first sermon, or first recorded sermon anyway. Now, verse 44 says, "I say unto you, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them," Matthew 5, that hate you. Pray for them that despitefully use you and persecute you, that you may be the children of your Father which is in heaven. For he makes his sun to rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rain on the just and on the unjust. For if you love them which love you, what reward have you? That's easy. You're not even the publicans the same. The publicans are not favored people in most biblical descriptions. And if you salute your brethren only, what do you more than others? Mafia hitmen love their children. Do not even the publicans so? Become you, no, it says be you, but it's become, the process. That's what the Greek means. Become you, therefore, perfect. So that there's no possible way to understand the Christian battle and the Christian goal, even as your Father, which is in heaven, is perfect. Is the Father perfect because Christ's righteousness is ascribed to him and he doesn't have to somehow do it? I'm speaking as a fool, as Paul said. When we follow Christ's steps, does that mean sort of it's a theological idea? We don't actually have to do exactly what Christ did in his life. In this case, we're describing overcoming sin. Recently, I've covered a lot on prophecy, and that's exciting. And we'll get back into it the next two times, and not the one after that, I can tell you. And most of the other sermons that the other men give are not on prophecy. Prophecy maybe should be covered. We were always taught this, maybe about once every 4 or 5 weeks. Well, that seems like a lot. Remember, that's a third of the Bible. A third of the Bible is prophecy. Two-thirds is everything else. Well, what you're really saying, the flip side of that coin, is 4 or 5 sermons out of 5 or 6 should not be prophecy. So let's be careful that we don't become sort of addicted to prophecy. We're talking about addictions here in a minute. And chapter 7 and verse 13, near the end of the Sermon on the Mount, Christ said this. Most people just don't get this. They think Christianity is a simple decision to walk down an aisle to an altar, give their heart to the Lord, profess Jesus, whatever, get baptized, and then go live the exact same way of life. And God's people must never, ever, ever forget that is the antithesis of true Christianity. Enter you in, verse 13, at the strait, or that means the difficult gate. Most people choose what's easy. That's why, even when their physical life is at stake, they won't exercise, they won't cut the sugar or the red meat or the chips or all the other things out of their life that's killing them. It's not easy. Ice cream tastes better than Brussels sprouts. I had 2 Brussels sprouts last night. I was reminded. Okay, and no ice cream. So it can talk to the person who forgot to serve that. I don't eat much ice cream because I choke the next day. I'm thankful. For wide is the gate, and broad is the way that leads to destruction. And many there be which go in that way. Thereat, it says, the awkward King James. Because straight or difficult is the gate, and narrow is the way which leads to life, and few there be that find it. Now the Greek is present progressive. It's are finding it. Very few. There are all kinds of pitfalls to being a true Christian. That's why there's so few of them. Now, I'll go back to what I was saying a moment ago. How can people think you don't have to follow Christ? Well, the answer is none of them even pick up their Bible. I don't think you could find 3 Christians in the entire world who, if I just cited those 5 verses, John 16, Revelation 3, 1 Peter 2, the verses that we covered there, Matthew 5, 48, and Matthew 7, 13, and 14, and I read those verses, they could tell you where they were. Or, either one, or I cited the name of those verses and they could tell you what all of them said. You might find some could hit 1 or 2 going either way. Give them the passage and they quote what it says, or give them what it says and they tell you where it is. And those are some of the most fundamental, impossible to misunderstand passages in the Bible. And if people were reading those verses, they would be out doing everything in their power to study all the rest of the verses that show them how to do it. Both were in the Sermon on the Mount, those last two verses. That's the most fundamental things you can understand. Luke 13:24 says the same, by the way. You don't have to turn there. The narrow is the way. Straight is the way. People tend to fall into addictions. And I want to talk about addictions. I've given an awful lot of sermons in my ministry on the subject of overcoming, never a single one on addictions. And addictions are exploding. There are very few good addictions. I'm going to give you a couple at the end of the sermon. Most people cannot do things in balance. For instance, turn over to Ecclesiastes chapter 3. Most people do not live their life this way. Ecclesiastes chapter 3 and verse 1. To everything there is a season and a time to every purpose under heaven. Now, let me just stop and say, not everything and every purpose. It's every lawful thing and every lawful purpose. So let's understand something. My purpose is to rob a bank. Well, there's a time for that. No, there's no time for that. I have a purpose to burn my house down and claim the money through insurance. No, there are a lot of things that you don't do. But to every right purpose, every lawful activity within God's Word, there is a purpose. And a lot of people cannot figure that out. A time to be born, a time to die. I'm just following my point here. A time to plant, a time to pluck up that which is planted. A lot of people know these verses. Very few seem to figure them out, because later in this very same book of Ecclesiastes, it says the heart of the wise discerns both time and judgment. What do you do and when do you do it? Most people can't figure out what to do, never mind when to do it. You've got some people who can figure out what to do, but not when to do it. Some people who can figure out something's got to be done now. This is the right time. They got the time down, but don't know what to do. Some can figure out what to do and when to do it, but don't have the strength to carry it out. So you got all kinds of different types of people. And so a lot of people cannot figure out what they should do when, or how much of something they should do. A time to kill and a time to heal. The Bible actually does say it is proper for a Christian to kill. I can show you that. Mortify your members. We'll see the verse later. God says to put to death certain problems you have. You need to bring to your overcoming, the Apostle Paul said, a killer's instinct. And when it comes to overcoming problems, you need to literally become a serial killer. You know what mortify means? It means put it to death. What's a mortuary? What does morbid come from? Time to kill, people would think. A time to heal. Time to break down, build up. Time to weep and laugh and mourn and dance. Some people love to dance and dance all the time. They go out every night. There'll be millions of people out at clubs tonight dancing around the world. And it'll be a problem because of other things happening and maybe even the way they're dancing. Time to cast away stones, gather stones, and so forth. A time, verse 6, to get or seek, a time to lose. Time to keep and cast away. To rend and sow, tear and sow. Time to keep silent, a time to speak. Those people can't figure out how to carry these things out. Time to love, a time to hate. Time of war and peace. All right, now let's consider something. Addictions are on the rise, all kinds of addictions. People are not born naturally balanced. Even in lawful things, they have to be taught, let your moderation be known to all people, to all men. They have to be taught, as the Apostle Paul also said, be temperate in all things, bring self-control. That's to the things you do, but we're going to talk here a little bit about addictions. Now, a lot of God's people, though most of them will not talk about it, live in a world surrounded by addicts, and some of God's people battle addictions, and some of them are serious, and those addictions will take you out of God's kingdom. You have to overcome. We already saw those verses, so let's keep it basic. 17.6 million American adults abuse alcohol or are alcohol dependent. Generally, more men than women are alcoholic, and alcohol problems are most prevalent among young adults ages 18 to 29. The younger you get, the less character still remains in society, and the more addictions just swallow people. 3 million kids, 14 to 17, are regular drinkers. Your children are growing up in that environment. One half of all adults have a family member who's an alcoholic. Half are exposed to them. Among the 28,000 plus cirrhosis deaths in 2005, 46% were alcohol related. 700,000 people in the United States are treated every day for alcohol addiction. 40% of children who start drinking before the age of 15 will become alcoholics at some point in their lives, compared with 25% of those who begin drinking at age 17. Isn't that interesting? And about 10% for those who start at 21 or 22. Parents, I hope you're listening. Young people around the world, people will hear this message in scores of countries around the world. I know that. The pressures on you are phenomenal. One of the reasons the reward for those who do God's work at the end of the age is protection from all that's coming is they are, in the most blunt way I can put it, we are up against it. This is the most degenerate, evil age where every vile practice is done anywhere in the world can be known 5 seconds later any other place in the world by a device you're holding in your hand. What is going on in this tiny, tiny little global community now called the world is phenomenal. Absolutely phenomenal. 76 million Americans, about 43%, have been exposed to alcoholism in the family. 22% of American adults are former drinkers. According to the National Institute of Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism, the United States economy loses an estimated $185 billion each year to alcohol-related problems. Patients with alcohol use problems consume more than 15% of the national health care budget. Why doesn't the health care program, the new public health care program, why doesn't it have a provision in it, we could put it this way, I'm speaking rhetorically, that forbids by law alcoholism then? If you go out and destroy yourself through the use of alcohol, we will not cover you. 15% savings right there. That was a choice you made. You go out and eat filthy, rotten foods, greasy, cheesy, fat-filled, palate-satisfying, body-exploding. Doing the best I can with adjectives here, brethren. Food, we will not cover you. Obesity is not a handicap. It's a sin. Alcoholism is not a disease. It's a sin. Christians overcome it. Gluttony is listed as a sin. God says people who are gluttons won't be in the kingdom of God. Nobody talks this way. They couldn't get elected. You can't go tell people to change. You wouldn't be elected dog catcher in a town with no dogs. All right, now let me go on. There are all kinds of other things I could mention. Alcohol problems cost U.S. employers $27 billion a year in lost production, much of that from absenteeism. You don't think it makes a difference? The work of God employs people all over the world. We have 55 or 60 employees here at headquarters. We don't have a problem with alcoholism. And it's because we're teetotalers. There's no alcoholism here. We don't suffer that. Trust me, as the chief executive officer of the corporation, now I'm talking about the church here, of the corporation, the Restored Church of God, Inc., I can tell you that would affect us, but it doesn't. We don't have that problem. It makes a big difference. Drugs. A world filled with addicts. Illicit drug use in the U.S. is at the highest level in 8 years. Now, these are 09 statistics. 1 in 12 Americans, aged 12 and older, an estimated 21.8 million people said they used illicit drugs in the month prior to the survey, that I'm quoting, 9% above the 08 level. The cartels aren't killing each other in mass on the other side of the Rio Grande and the American border because people aren't buying up here. It's a death struggle because there's tremendous profits north of the Rio Grande. The rise was driven largely by an increase in the use of marijuana, and then it talks about percentages. Among those aged 50 to 59, the rate of past month illicit drug use increased from 2.7% in 02 to 6.2% in 09. 50 to 59-year-olds. Now, that's over doubling in a period of 7 years in a very high-end category age-wise. Almost 37 million Americans ages 12 and older have tried cocaine. Can you imagine how far I could go with statistics? 19.5% of 8th graders, 28-plus percent of 10th graders, 39% of 12th graders surveyed in 08 reported that powder cocaine was fairly easy or very easy to obtain. Astonishing. 8th graders, what are they, 12, 13 maybe? And they'll say it's very easy to get. Chronic methamphetamine use brings violent behavior, psychotic behavior, auditory hallucinations, mood disturbances, delusions and paranoia, homicidal or suicidal thoughts. Why would anybody do it then? The answer is they can't stop themselves. They have no purpose in life. They don't know why they were born. They can read those kinds of things, but they'll tell themselves they'll be an exception. Before we go on, let's now for a moment turn over to the book of Proverbs, Proverbs chapter 25. Proverbs 25. We're going to look at two verses in the Proverbs. And verse 28. He that has no rule over his own spirit, Proverbs 25, 28, is like a city that is broken down and without walls. Now, what does that mean? When that was written approximately 3,000 years ago and Solomon recorded it, basically cities had walls around them. They don't today because the world is policed differently, but they had walls to keep bandits, wild animals, and invaders out. So it would make perfect sense to one of 3,000 years ago reading that, when your wall is gone, you're defenseless. So you're talking about your defense. There are two kinds of people that can walk through a mall. There are those who can see the things they want and stop themselves, and there are those who can't. Maybe they're shopaholics of one degree or another, but they're covetous and can't stop. They can walk down the same path, look in the same windows, have the exact same needs, and one can stop himself and the other can't because he can't rule his spirit. He's defenseless. There's no walls around him to protect him. Ruling your spirit literally protects you from all the wrong appetites, or even too much of, go back to Ecclesiastes 3, right appetites. Dancing's fine if it's the right kind of dancing, right circumstance. We're going to have a dancer 2 weeks from tonight, I guess. Nothing wrong with dancing. But if you want to dance all the time, it's out of balance, using an analogy. All right, let's go to another one, gambling. Now, this is legal. Drug use is not, although it's creeping along. Alcoholism is legal. It's a sin, but it's legal as long as you don't drive after a certain point. You're drinking. One's drinking. Legalized gambling generates from $60 billion to $190 billion per year for the gaming industry. What if people weren't spending their money that way? Gambling in some form is legal in all states but two, Utah and Hawaii. Recent research reveals that in America, approximately 2.5 million adults suffer from compulsive gambling. They can't stop themselves. About 3 million are considered problem gamblers, and 15 million adults are now under the risk of becoming problem gamblers. But it's big money. And so because people with wealth, there's a big casino going to be built up here in Cleveland by a billionaire, the guy that owns the Cavs, because he can't stop himself. Let's just start with that. I mean, I'm not trying to put him down. I'm trying to illustrate. He can't stop himself from the lure of tremendous revenue. He's going to build a device called a casino that will attract vast numbers who can't stop themselves from destroying their life when they enter his building. And most people don't talk that way. I watched on 60 Minutes when the governor of Pennsylvania got angry a few months ago upon being questioned. Well, if we don't allow gambling in Pennsylvania, everybody else does. Can't you see that? Boy, he got angry. I never saw him. So, you know, this particular man, normally a very cool head, got angry at the thought that he couldn't allow people in his state to gamble because everybody else does. They'll just go to Atlantic City or Ohio or New York or Maryland or all the states around Pennsylvania and do it. There's no thought whatsoever. We will take a stand on courage and rightness and set an example for others because the revenue is too great. He can't resist the state revenue. And, of course, with the compounding of problems is a different subject. Pennsylvania is one of the 46 states in the United States that's underwater, deficit spending. Everybody focuses on the federal government. They don't realize that all of the big cities of America and 46 out of 50 or 92% of the states in the country are also overspending. Why? Why do governments overspend? They can't stop themselves. It's an addiction. You'll even hear the Republicans, who spend way too much as well, talk about how the Democrats are addicted. Well, that's like somebody who's addicted to a powder cocaine saying, see a guy who takes crystal meth? He's an addict. I need to keep this conversation short because I've got to go home and smoke marijuana. Might be the rest of it. I mean, it's so silly to listen to these people. The Gambling Addiction Index shows that 80% and above of the nation's adults have engaged in gambling at least once in their lives. It also reveals that more than $500 billion is spent annually on wagers. Poker online, there's so many programs now that promote it. Now, I've worked with people who have gambling addictions. I've worked with people who have drug and alcohol addictions. And once you're addicted to something, it is powerful, but you have to overcome, or you will not rule with Christ. If you're foolish enough to get into that kind of stuff, listen, I'm going to talk to God's people. There's only been one final end of the age. I'm going to talk to God's people on this matter. Understand, we are a church that doesn't do these things. We don't care if all other peoples on the face of the earth do. They're not offered the same salvation yet that we are. If you are in the church and you are battling any one of the addictions I've mentioned and some yet to come, you have to beat them, and we'll try to help you. To cover them up, you know, the Bible says he that covers his sins won't prosper. In any given year, at least 2.9% of the adult population falls under either problem gamblers or pathological gamblers. Every single year, one in every 33 people in the adult population of America, you see 33 people, one of them just succumbed to gambling that year, and the next year there'll be another one. Consumers spend more on legal gaming in the U.S. than most other forms of entertainment combined. Think it isn't a problem? 25 to 50% of spouses of pathological gamblers have been abused. That's another little hidden problem that happens in the closet. You come home frustrated because you blew your wad at the table or at the slot machine, and somebody gets punched out, sometimes children. As access to money becomes more limited, gamblers often resort to crime in order to pay debts, appease bookies, maintain appearances, and garner more money to gamble. A quote from the National Research Council. Addictions destroy people. Your city broken down without walls. Studies of Gamblers Anonymous, GA, members report that approximately half of the participants had stolen to gamble and over one-third had been arrested. Stunning. The vast majority of gambling-related crimes are nonviolent. Embezzlement, check forgery, stealing credit cards, fencing stolen goods, tax evasion, insurance fraud, employee theft and fraud are common gambling-related crimes. Christians don't gamble. If you do, it'll destroy you in this life before it takes you out of the next one, an eternal life. Work. Work would be bad? Well, God says 6 days shall you labor. There are people who have to work all the time, 10, 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. Therefore, just on its surface, for a Christian, that's a sin, isn't it? 6 days shall you work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. A loving Creator takes a day away from you, repackages it, and gives it back to you for physical, spiritual, mental, emotional, social, psychological, every other kind of rest. You're not allowed to be a workaholic. Now, the flip side of it is 6 days shall you labor. Labor's good, but one day a week, it's an absolute sin. says Christ, who calls himself the Lord of the Sabbath day in the book that Christians never read. Even when out of the office, workaholics can satisfy their cravings with cell phones, PDAs, laptops, and Wi-Fi. Now you're never away from your work. You can't leave your work at the office because it'll buzz in your pocket. It's at your computer at home. It's important to understand the context, says this one doctor. If you're working to the exclusion of your family, marriage, relationships, and your life is out of balance, or your physical health is out of balance, when work takes an exclusive priority to everything else, that's the more extreme end of the spectrum when it becomes a problem. They're workaholics. They're people who can't be moderate in anything that they do, and they have a particular weakness that way. They can't be temperate in anything. Because typically, if you're doing way too much of something, one thing all the time, there are many other things you're not doing at all. That's intemperate in two different ways. Had you ever thought of that? Like other forms of addiction, workaholism can have significant health consequences, experts say, including significantly higher work-related stress and job burnout rates, anger, depression, anxiety, and psychosomatic symptoms such as stomach aches and headaches. Is the Bible right when it says you're defenseless if you don't defeat it? Look at Proverbs 16 and verse 32. Proverbs 16 and verse 32. Here's the other side of those who rule their spirit. Look at how God values those who can control themselves, which, by the way, is the seventh fruit of the Spirit, self-control. Temperance, it's called temperance. In the world, they think temperance is abstinence. The WCTU, you'll hear of it, the Women's Christian Temperance Union. It should be called the WCAU because they advocate abstinence, not temperance, not temperance with alcohol. To them, it's abstinence. Now, for some, it has to be abstinence. For some who have a problem, put it away. If your hand offends you, cut it off, cast it from you. If there's something you can't do a little that's lawful, stop it. Don't do it at all. It'll destroy you. That's what Christ meant. He said, pluck your eye out. Take drastic action. Defeat your problems. We will have people next Sunday night who will dab a little bit of wine on their tongue, who are former alcoholics, who know that they cannot take any more than that with the bread. I've counseled them for decades because even drinking a little bit of wine, there will be people in this church who are wise enough to know don't go there with even that much. And a judgment has been made as long as they take some, because Christ said, except you eat this bread and drink this wine, you have no part with me. They have to take some, or that becomes a sin. They have to have a little bit of faith to take some, and we tell them, just dab your tongue. But, verse 32, Proverbs 16, he that is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he that rules his spirit than he that takes a city. When great cities of the world are taken by generals, they're considered great leaders, great generals. God says anybody who can just rule his spirit is greater in my sight than some 3- or 4-star general. Patton or MacArthur or Wellington, who beat Napoleon at Waterloo. Meade, who beat Lee at Gettysburg. And those men are celebrated in history. In God's sight, they're not nearly as great as somebody who can just control himself. Now remember, this sermon does not get into all the verses within the subject about how I can of mine own self do nothing, Christ said. With men, certain things are impossible. With God, all things are possible. Paul said, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. You can't go out and do this on human steam, although there are people who defeat gambling, who defeat alcohol, who defeat drugs or workaholism on human steam. Smoking, it can be done because people do it every day by the many thousands in every one of those categories. But a Christian doesn't have to. He has help. He gets help. Pornography. What a horrendous addiction this is for vast millions. 70% of all movies watched in hotels and motels across this country are adult movies. 30% is everything else. Now, you think we got a problem with pornography just on that alone? At a point several years ago, 3,000 new pornographic websites started every day. That's because there was no market, right? Every second, 3,000 $100 is being spent on pornography every second. Every second, 28,250 internet users are viewing pornography. Every 39 minutes, a new pornographic video is being created in the United States. Day in, day out, day in, day out. The pornography industry has larger revenues than Microsoft, Google, Amazon, eBay, Yahoo, Apple, and Netflix combined. That's because there's no problem out there. And these problems will come after. They will pursue and hound you like a pack of dogs that you can't get off your trail. If you don't have strength, if you don't have the ability to rule your spirit, if the walls around your town are broken down, fix them, build them up. It's going to get worse and worse and worse on this little island in the storm that is the Church of the Living God. In 2006, worldwide pornography revenues ballooned to $97 billion plus. Way over, that's 5 years ago. A total of 4.2 million websites contain pornography. That's 420 million pornographic pages, 12% of the total number of all websites. 1/8 of all websites are pornographic. Daily pornographic search engine requests. 68 million people ask a search engine to get them to where they can wallow in that cesspool. Do you think, I think, having pastored 11,000 people in my life, made 25,000 visits knocking on people's doors, that I would think some of God's people are not dabbling in these terrible, destructive devices? Oh, listen. I could write literature as much as all that I've written just on the case studies of people I've seen. They will defeat God's people if God's people don't seize their problems by the lapel, as it were. As I like to say, it's you or me, friend, and it's not going to be me. You better be careful. Just one thing, it's fun to talk about prophecy. It's fun to learn how to pray. It's fun to get doctrine straight. But it comes down to, what are you overcoming and defeating? How much, Mr. Pack? Even as Christ did, perfect as your Father in heaven. 1 in 7 youths report being solicited for sex in chat rooms. 72 million worldwide visitors to pornographic websites every month. Professing Christians who said pornography is a major problem in their home, 47%. Now, how do they define major problem? Oh, I have it under control. I only do it 3 nights a week. So I wouldn't be in that 47%. I mean, I don't know what they mean. What's that mean? If it's any kind of a problem, it shouldn't be 47% or any percent who report it's even in their home. I've never been, not one time. I'm thankful I don't know how to use computers. I'm the Fred Flintstone of computer users. Unfortunately, I'm not married to Wilma, Flintstone aficionados, so she knows how to use them, but I wouldn't know how to go. 28% of those admitting to internet sexual addiction are women. It's not all men. A little over 1 in 4. Now on the other side, it's a little, almost 3 in 4 are men. 2003, the internet was a significant factor in 2 out of 3 divorces. Wow. Wow. American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers report. The adult industry says its traffic is 20 to 30% children. Largest consumer of internet pornography, 12 to 17-year-old age group as of 2007. What chance do they have for a happy life? Astonishing. I have an article here. Is dating dead? A week ago, front page of USA Today. 72% of college students are no longer virgins on their wedding day. 28% are. But within the 28% are those who say, oh, I saved myself for marriage. So we practice sodomy and oral sex, and they get to be counted in the 28% who are virgins. That's how the survey went. 72%. No, we're just straight sex. And they talk about that the subject is dating dead, and basically the article concluded it's dead. It's about sex the first night. And because 55% of all the students in colleges in the United States are women, now 45% are men, the women say because they have to compete for men, they have to drop all the standards from the past, they're gone. the most horrific statistics and stories and examples I have ever read in my life. And this thing of hooking up, because pornography takes you there. That's what God says, flee fornication. You can fornicate in your mind. He that looks on a woman to lust after her has committed adultery in his heart. What about if she's on a screen? That's adultery. You're an adulterer. What if you're not married? Well, then you're a fornicator by extraction, the same definition. But these are talking about people who are just straight into it. What's the point? You hear the quote. What's the point of dating? Why pay money to go have a date when the women are pursuing you because they outnumber us? The guys are whole king of the hill. And some of that 28% just say, well, I'm too ugly to be able to have sex. It's astonishing. Astonishing. Vast tens of thousands will have sex tonight with people, and they literally won't ask and don't want to know their name. They want to keep it nameless and faceless. So they can do it with somebody else the next night. And if they have a name attached to who they have sex with tonight, then they could catch feelings for them, and they don't want that because they can't go out and sample other kinds of fruit. They'll be stuck with just bananas when they want to try all other kinds of fruit. You listen to the analogies they use. It's unbelievable. As I put it in the sex book, they're big game fishermen trolling the open ocean, and they'll hook just about anything. It's astonishing. 9 out of 10 children aged between 8 and 16 have viewed pornography on the internet. 90% starting with 8-year-olds. Now, young people are coming into the church. All over the world, I can just tell you, we have people attending the Restored Church of God today for the first time, sitting alongside people who may be 45 years in the church. I'm 45 years in the church. There they both sit. First Sabbath or 2000th Sabbath, whatever it may be. And we have to realize they're coming in. Our ministers have to realize it. Can you imagine the apostles having to deal with this in the first century? The 21st century is so vastly beyond in reach. The number of pitfalls, slime pits, you know, and cesspools that can pull people in. It's almost unimaginable to all previous ages of people God worked with. That's why there's this little group that finishes this awesome work as a tiny number. In the darkest age in the history of the world, they get protected in an extraordinary way. 57% of pastors say that addiction to pornography is the most sexually damaging issue to their congregation out in the world. Okay. Average age of first exposure to internet pornography, 11. Average. Never before in the history of telecommunications media in the United States has so much indecent and obscene material been so easily accessible by so many minors in so many American homes with so few restrictions, end of quote, from the United States Department of Justice. And of course, we could just talk about sex addiction. Sexaholics Anonymous, SA is out there along with AA and GA, you know, Gamblers Anonymous and all the others. Spectacular. It's like a conquest. It's a notch on your belt to millions. Now women as much as men. Food. Food addiction is also called compulsive overeating. God calls it gluttony. Results in overweight condition or obesity with all the related problems, diabetes, heart disease, joint damage, cancer, and early death. We just heard about that earlier. Here are the nations with the highest obesity rates, the United States, 30.6%. Now I look around and I see so many fat people. In West Virginia, it's close to half. Mexico, 24%. Portugal's down to 12.8%. How wonderful. One in eight people in Portugal is fat. But this is morbid obesity or serious obesity. The medical cost, care costs of obesity in the United States are staggering. In 2008 dollars, these costs totaled about $147 billion. 2008 was ancient history. I wish I could give you all the 10 statistics or even into 11. I can't. Kleptomania, here's another one. I've dealt with kleptomaniacs. They can't help themselves from stealing. They get these powerful urges to steal items that they don't need. They get these feelings of increased tension leading up to the theft, and they have to carry out a theft because the tension's just building up until they can break it and ease it. Like some people would take a cigarette or go jogging, they only get relief when they steal. They have to steal to get relief, and then it'll build again. For gamblers, it's the exact same feeling, only they got to gamble again. For sexaholics, drugs, exact same feeling, but most of us would never believe that kleptomaniacs, pyromaniacs, they get this, I won't do it again. Then it develops, and until they learn to rule their spirit, and the world is not seeking God, it doesn't understand that God gives a spirit, Paul wrote Timothy, of power, love, and a sound mind, Greek dunamis. It's dynamic power. They don't know about that. Neither do Christians who, again, don't read the book they profess to follow and believe. They get a feeling of pleasure and gratification while stealing. It's a high. They're actually snorting illegal goods, if you will. And then they get a feeling of terrible guilt or shame after the theft, just like an addict would, just like a gambling addict would who just blew his wad or was all night on crack. Most of us don't know that. That's why God says we have to put away thefts, including even purloining, Paul wrote, which is petty thievery. Unlike typical shoplifters, people with kleptomania don't compulsively steal for personal gain, nor do they steal as a way to exact revenge. They do it simply because the urge is so powerful they can't resist it. This urge makes them feel uncomfortably anxious, tense, or aroused. To soothe these feelings, they must steal. During the theft, they feel relief and gratification. Afterward, though, they feel enormous guilt, remorse, self-loathing, and fear of arrest. But the urge comes back and the kleptomania cycle repeats itself. End of quote. National Association for Shoplifting Prevention. More than $13 billion worth of goods are stolen from retailers every year. It's called shrinkage. Oh, the shrinkage. What's that? You go in one day, you come back the next day, and all your products shrank. No. Shrinkage is it just disappears. When I inherited my father's company, I knew I was going to lose thousands of dollars to shoplifters. I knew it. I just had to accept it. It's called shrinkage. That's more than $35 million per day. There are approximately 27 million shoplifters, or one in every 11 people in our nation today. See, 11 people, one of them's a shoplifter. More than 10 million have been caught shoplifting in the last 5 years, and it usually doesn't stop them. The first really serious kleptomaniac I had to work with said he'd been involved 200 times and been arrested 30, and they just let him go. Out he goes, because they can't keep up with them. Well, no wonder, 27 million people, and they don't all do it once a year. So how many incidents are there that could fall on the police, assuming they would all be caught? And of course they aren't. Shoplifting affects more than the offender. It overburdens the police and the courts, adds to the store's security expenses, costs consumers more for goods, costs communities lost dollars in sales taxes, and hurts children and families. There's no profile of a typical shoplifter, however. Men and women shoplift about equally as often. 25% of shoplifters are kids, 75% are adults. 55% of adult shoplifters say they started in their teens. These are addictions, and God's people have to defeat them. Here's another one, Internet. I'm going over, but it's important. According to the Stanford University School of Medicine study, 1 of 8 Americans suffer from Internet addiction. You watch these little kids, boom, 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 and they're punching their thumbs, and they're playing video games, or they're texting each other. I don't know how many times I have sat and watched two people sitting across from each other, 3 feet away, texting each other. Said, hey, Bob, yeah, Joe, what's on your mind? Well, Bob, you know, and they talk. No, they text each other. Incredible. I always say of the current generation, there's not a single thing wrong with them. Maybe a few. They can't read, write, spell, think, or reason. Other than that, they're swell. Because they play these, they're addicted. They never build a doghouse, never cast a fishing pole into line and watched a bobber go under because the fish took it. They've never cleaned up after a bird or had a pet or cut the grass or did anything. They got cell phones growing out of their ears, calling and telling people where they are at the mall. What are you doing? I'm getting my hair fixed. Where are you going? I'm going into McDonald's. What are you doing? I don't know. I'm going to the next store. It's unbelievable. The most mindless, they have to play with these technical toys. that for 6,000 years people found they could get along without. And boy, I don't want to use computers. I don't use a cell phone more than twice a year. I just say, honey, dial this number. No, anyway, I do at times. 14% of respondents found it hard to abstain from internet use for several days. 5.9% said excessive use affected their relationships, and over 8% said the internet was a means of escape from the real world. 71% of office workers abused the internet during work hours. Visiting social networking sites, shopping online, reading personal email, or visiting pornography, gaming, or gambling sites. Individuals who suffer from depression, anxiety disorders, and social phobia and other compulsive disorders are more likely to develop internet addiction. There are young people who literally have killed themselves because they couldn't turn their computer off and they're playing with video games. They've literally, 12, 14, 15-year-olds, fall dead because they couldn't stop. It's true. Cyber sex addiction, online affairs, and online gaming are the most common forms of internet addiction. Internet predators are twice as likely to suffer from internet addiction. According to the Chinese government, approximately 13% of Chinese teenagers suffer from internet addiction and have banned the opening of internet cafes for the entire year 2007. The government of China funded a military-style boot camp to combat the disease that had gotten so bad. We don't hear most of this. In Germany, estimates suggest that close to 1 million people are addicted to the internet, or about 3% of the German online population, 1 in 33. In Amsterdam, the first internet detoxification center to treat video game addiction opened in 2006. Astonishing stuff. In 2009, television was the dominant leisure activity for the average person, 2.82 hours a day. Second was socializing. The average person only socializes 42 minutes compared to about, what, 2 hours and 50 minutes a day on television. And kids are 7 hours a day. So there are a lot of people who don't do it. Here's some bizarre new addictions where it's obvious demon activity is involved. I'll close with this before some summary comments. The cable news channel TLC has a show titled My Strange Addiction. It follows people who struggle with bizarre new addictions. But remember, in an age where there's no mental muscle, people cannot slam shut any steel doors in their minds because they don't have any steel doors. They've never been taught that they should build them, that they need them. So listen to the way this goes. Their website describes the show like this. My Strange Addiction tells the compelling stories of people who are battling obsessive behaviors on the verge of taking over their lives. Follow these addicts as they reveal their strange addictions and meet with psychological experts. How many people would be interested in that? All the addicts all over the country might figure, let's see what I can learn about people who have these problems, or worse than I am, they might think too. Some of the stories include a woman who's been addicted to eating household cleanser for over 30 years, eating it up to 10 times a day. That's sick. A 22-year-old woman who's addicted to pulling her hair out. She suffers from a thing called trichotillomania, a compulsion to pull out her hair. Estimate around 5 million people in the United States are addicted to ripping their hair out. People being called out of the world into God's church do these things. In some proportion. One woman is addicted to buying shoes, has over 200 pairs, and has spent more than $45,000 just on shoes. Another woman, seems like a lot of these are women, is addicted to eating couch cushions. Hopefully she salts and peppers them, I don't know. Another woman is addicted to extreme bodybuilding, used to be addicted to drugs and alcohol, thought that was bad, had to find another addiction, and now works out 6 days a week, 6 hours a day. Another woman is addicted to tanning and frequents tanning beds up to 3 times a day along with tanning outside. This unhealthy dependence on tanning has been called tanorexia. How creative. Another individual is addicted to cleaning, spending 8 hours a day cleaning. Other people shower and they clean themselves. They'll take 30, 40, 50, 60 showers a day. They have their main one early on and the rest they call quickies. Some are addicted to buying cats and dogs. More and more people are now addicted to eating dirt. Although this may be regarded as strange and unappetizing by most, it could be nutritionally beneficial. Unbelievable. anyway, I'm not going to even read the rest of those. It is sometimes associated with pica, or the uncontrollable desire to consume non-food items such as coins, buttons, cotton, etc. And then there are people who are addicted to swallowing sharp objects, metal objects. And even other people have to eat nails and rocks, millions of them. Others eat ice. Pagophagia involves the constant chewing of ice with the consumption of ice drinks and so forth. There are some addicted to thinness. They're called anorexics, and it killed Karen Carpenter and many others. Others are addicted to bulimia. They love the feeling of vomiting because, A, they can either eat more or they can stay thin. They can serve either gluttony or anorexia if they can just get themselves to enjoy bulimia, and then after a point, they become addicted to it. All of our ministers must say what I'm going to say to you as they work with people. Some concluding thoughts. One must overcome these problems. They must overcome these problems. They have to. They have no hope. They have no hope whatsoever if they do not overcome their problems. If you faint in the day of adversity, your strength is small. The Apostle Paul described the battle in Romans 7, verses 5 to 25. You ought to read it. You can't faint in the day of adversity. I'm out of time, but I'd like you to read on your own. I usually don't do this, but I'd like you to read on your own Colossians 3, verses 1 to 15. Colossians 3, verses 1 to 15. Now, interestingly enough, Paul wrote the Corinthians in this final verse. Paul wrote the Corinthians this. Here's a good addiction. 1 Corinthians 16, 15. I beseech you, brethren, you know the house of Stephanas, that it is the first fruits of Achaia, and that they have addicted themselves to the ministry of the saints, that you submit yourself unto such. God's ministers are told, interestingly enough, in the scriptures, and it's talking about ministers, because these are people you submit to, that would be the ministry, that's the context, not people are addicted to serving the ministers. That's not what it means, the ministry of the saints to the ministers. But God's ministers should be addicted to serving people. That's an addiction that's good. So says the Bible. And here's the last one. All of you ought to be focused on and set your mind and your affections, as Colossians 3 says, on developing the addiction to overcoming. A desire accomplished is sweet to the soul, Proverbs says. Teach yourself to defeat all the problems that threaten to, trying to defeat you. And as you do, an extraordinary power comes from it. Anybody who's ever overcome anything knows it. It tastes and feels so good, you want more. If you're going to become perfect, we could say you ought to, and maybe have to, develop an addiction to changing, repenting, overcoming. If you do, you build a city with a very high and thick wall that cannot be penetrated. You can rule your spirit, and you've exercised what the Bible calls the ninth fruit of the Spirit. Now, next time I speak, actually the next two times I speak, I'm going to be even touching on, within the final two parts on the series of the days of the Son of Man, some things that actually relate here a little bit. But the next time I come back, we will get into prophecy in two very dramatic, powerful final parts of that series.